covenant, as God tells Abraham, I will bless those who bless you, curse those who curse you, and in you all the nations of the earth will be blessed. And those three portions of the Abrahamic covenant, land, seed, and blessing, and how those really undergird not only all of the Pentateuch, but all of the Old Testament. And then laid on top of that is the Mosaic covenant, or the law covenant. The people have come into covenant relationship with God, where God says, you are my particular people. If you act in this way, you will receive great blessing. You will remain secure in the land. But if you violate this covenant, there will be severe consequences. And of course, they waste no time in violating that covenant. Moving on from the Torah, we moved into the historical books, really, which are considered as part of the prophetic writings. And there is some prophecy in there. Specifically, what we focused on in that portion was 2 Samuel 7. And in 2 Samuel 7, what we see is the Davidic covenant, the next major covenant that God makes with his people, and really not even the whole of the people, a specific family, the house and the line of David. And he promises a king that will come, one that will rule not only over the house of Israel, but over all of the nations, and one that will rule not like any other king, but will rule with complete justice and righteousness, and whose reign will never end. And if you take those covenants, if you take the Abrahamic covenant, the Mosaic covenant, and the Davidic covenant, you really see, if you read the prophets in light of those covenants, they are woven all the way through. As the prophets correct and condemn the people, it is because of their Mosaic law covenant violations. As they encourage the people with messages of restoration, it is not because they will suddenly start obeying the law. It is because they will be renewed according to a new covenant that is based on God's faithfulness to his past covenants. All right, so as we work through Psalms, that's what we saw. From there, we moved into the prophets, and the prophets are divided into major and minor prophets. The message of the major prophets, basically twofold, judgment and restoration, given in broad terms, written in longer letters, and then the minor prophets that speak of judgment and restoration, but usually in more specific terms to specific people, shorter letters, more pointed, but very, very critical nonetheless. And we saw that a lot of those messages, a lot of the promises of restoration and judgment are tied to Israel and Israel's coming judgment and coming restoration. And what we kept seeing over and over was the idea that this restoration for Israel is both a physical restoration and a spiritual restoration. Those things are not at war. They don't compete with one another. One doesn't supersede the other. Very, very often in the prophetic narrative, those things are tied together. Israel is pictured as renewed and restored as a nation, placed in a position of prominence among all the nations, and with that is given their spiritual restoration, their newness of heart, their mourning and weeping over their sin, their wholehearted devotion to Yahweh, the God who chose them and saves them. So those two things work together, and we see that as one happens, as the spiritual restoration of Israel happens, so too does their physical restoration. And so we look forward to those things. Today, we move into the Psalms, the writings. They are distinct from the prophets. They cover a variety of authors in the one book. We won't cover all of the writings. We're really only going to cover the book of Psalms as it relates to kingdom narrative. There are several Psalms that deal with the kingdom. Maybe not as explicitly as the prophetic writings did, but they certainly aid in our understanding of God's kingdom program and how that will play out. Now, as we come to the Psalms, there are some things that we need to understand. They were written over a very long period of time, from Moses till well after David. So you have Psalms written over a period of hundreds of years by a variety of authors that cover a variety of circumstances. The Psalms really are quite beautiful in that they cover kind of the range of human experience. Feeling joyful, there is definitely a psalm for that. If you're feeling sorrowful, there is a psalm for that. If you're afraid, there's a psalm for that. If you're confident, there's psalms for that. They are beautifully written in that they encompass kind of the range of our whole human experience. They cover victory over sin. They cover failure within sin, and repentance and what that looks like. They cover great confidence in God and his work. They cover the difficult things like the questioning, where is God in times of difficulty, sorrow, and suffering? They are very, very comprehensive. They are written distinctly. The Psalms have their own vocabulary in a way. The Psalms have their own punctuation, quite literally. The Psalms are, they look verbally and grammatically different than many other places in Scripture. So you use some different things when you translate them. They are written distinctly. Hebrew poetry, which the Psalms are, is distinct from Hebrew prose or regular writing. One of the most consistent things that you will see that characterize it is the idea of couplets or doubling ideas. You'll see the author state one thing and then state it again in different words. And where our English minds like to try to find the nuances and the difference between the two, it's just a very poetic way of reiterating the same idea quite often. But they use lots of language of imagery and metaphor, word pictures. The very nice thing is, though, those are given by literary devices. Similes and metaphors are very, very clear. You don't have to wonder when David or the psalmist or whoever happens to be writing is giving a literal thing or a figurative thing. It does come across very clearly with the context. So given those things, let's jump into the Psalms, and we will cover a few of them today briefly and not sufficiently enough, but we will do what we can. Turn to Psalm 2 for me. Psalm 2. You probably don't have to go very far to find it. Psalm 2 is a psalm where in the Psalter itself, we're not told who wrote it. However, the New Testament confirms the idea that it was a psalm of David. Jesus asks the question of the Pharisees specifically relating to this psalm, and David is the answer for who wrote it. So this is a Davidic psalm, and there are three primary characters in this. Well, one is a group of characters. There are the nations and the leaders of the nations of the earth. There is the Lord, Yahweh, and then there's this one called the Anointed, Yahweh's Anointed, or his Appointed One. And there are some very critical things that we have to see. Verse 1, why are the nations in an uproar and the peoples devising a vain thing? The kings of the earth take their stand and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his Anointed. In other words, the kingdoms of the earth have decided that they have had enough of the influence of the Lord and they are openly going to war against him. They are openly rebelling against the Lord. In other words, at some point, the nations seek to cast off any influence or authority of the God of heaven. Now, God has a very, very specific response to that in verse 4. He who sits in the heavens laughs. The Lord scoffs at them. If you ever wonder how concerned God is about the rebellion of nations, look at Psalm 2. The nations are as a drop of water in the bucket. They are not threatening in the least to him. It would be very much like a child. Nathan is roughly 6 years old. If he were to throw himself into a rage and threaten to beat me up, I would most likely laugh at him. He's tough, but he's small. And really, on an infinitely greater scale, this is what you have. The nations raging, shaking their fists against the God of heaven who created all things, and his right response is quite literally to laugh at them. He'll speak to them in his anger, verse 5, and terrify them in his fury. And this is his response. To the uproar and the rage of the nations, this is God's response. But as for me, I have installed my king upon Zion, my holy mountain. God's response to the nations is that he has done exactly what he will do. He has installed his king without consulting them, without asking for their approval, and he will carry out his will exactly as he intends to. And look at verse 7, it's very important. I will surely tell of the decree of the Lord. He has said to me, you are my son, I have begotten you. We see that the king, the one that the Lord installs on the throne, is called the Son of God. Not just a Son of God, but the Son of God. And of course, this has tremendous messianic and Christological implications in how we understand the person and the work of Christ. Hebrews refers to this. It's referred to several other times as Christ being the one who is set over the nations. I will surely tell of the decree of the Lord. You are my son. Today I have begotten you. Ask of me, and I will, future tense, surely give the nations as your inheritance, the very ends of the earth as your possession. This king will not only rule over Israel, this king will have the nations, plural, all of the nations as his inheritance, and the ends of the earth as his rule. Remember, I said that one of the aspects of Hebrew poetry is this idea of doubling. That verse 8 is a good example of that. Ask and I'll give the nations as your inheritance, the very ends of the earth as your possession. What that is saying is that this king's rule will be a universal rule. This is a divine king, and this is a king that rules over all. And when he rules, look at what verse 9 says, you will break them with a rod of iron, you shall shatter them like earthenware. This king will not put up with rebellion. There is no Davidic king at any time in the past that was able to adequately shatter the rebellion of those that came against them. David certainly defeated his enemy. Solomon certainly expanded the kingdom. But he was not able to shatter nations like earthenware. Their reign never extended to the ends of the earth. In fact, it was a very, very small kingdom, especially as you put it in light of the kingdoms of Rome, of the kingdoms of Persia and Greece and things like that. The kingdom, even at its greatest, really paled in comparison to those. So this speaks of a time that is coming in the distant future. What's the only logical response to that? Look at verse 10 to 12. Now therefore, O kings, show discernment. Take warning, O judges of the earth. Worship the Lord with reverence and rejoice with trembling. Do homage to the Son. Kiss the Son, literally, that he might not become angry and you perish in the way, for his wrath might soon be kindled. How blessed are all those who take refuge in him. There's only two responses, either worship the king or rebel against the king. And there's only two responses from the king, either wrath against the rebellion or refuge for those who worship him. So Psalm 2 really gives us some very interesting details about the coming king, that he is a divine king, that he will rule with a rod of iron, and that he will rule over all of the nations in that coming day. Any questions on that so far? We're going to move on quickly to Psalm 8. Psalm 8. Now, this is not specifically a kingdom-related psalm. But what Psalm 8 does is it works back to kind of what we saw in Genesis 1, this design and purpose that man was given. Because what was the purpose that man was given in Genesis chapter 1? Worship the Lord? Good, absolutely. Man was created to worship God at all times, even from the very beginning. And as God created man, what did he specifically tell them to do? Be fruitful and multiply. Fill the earth and subdue it. That was man's charge. Be fruitful and multiply. Fill the earth. Have kids and have lots of them. And fill the earth so that you can subdue it, so that you can rule over it. Man was created in the image of God to rule as the vice regent, if you will, over creation, with God as the ultimate ruler, of course. But man was given to rule over creation. Now, when sin came, when the fall happened, what you see is that is kind of turned on its head. And now man, to one degree or another, fears creation, doesn't he? I mean, how many of you are going hanging out in the tiger cage at the zoo? It's not happening, right? Why? Because no matter how sternly you use your big boy voice, if you tell that tiger, I have dominion over you, you better not, you're probably going to get eaten. And so it seems, at least on the outside, at least in the world that we live in, that sin has somehow diminished or removed that creation mandate that God gave man. Psalm 8 is very interesting in that it tells us that that is not the case. The command from Genesis 1 was to fill the earth and subdue it, and this psalm reminds us that that is still in play. Look at Psalm 8, verse 5. Yet you, that is God, have made him, that is man, a little lower than God. And you crown him with glory and majesty. You make him to rule over the works of your hands. You put all things under his feet. All sheep and oxen, beasts of the field, the birds of the heavens, the fish of the sea, whatever passes through the paths of the sea. Mankind is given glory and honor, and we say, what glory and honor? Well, this psalm again is quoted in Hebrews, specifically referring to Christ. And it is very interesting that in the end, a man, the last Adam, Jesus Christ being truly man and truly God, but a man will undo the work of the curse that a man, Adam, brought into the world. And Psalm 8 is a reminder that just as a man will undo that curse, through him, mankind will also be restored to the place that it was designed for. We looked at those portions in Isaiah, and when he talks specifically in the last third of that book about what creation will be like when that renewed kingdom, when the Lord rules. And we saw, what did we see? We saw the kids play with snakes, right? Lions lay down with lambs, those things that we're familiar with. But it speaks to the idea of this abundance in creation, and not only abundance, but this peace in creation, the idea that the order of creation is restored. that man is again placed in a position of authority over creation, where there's not the war between them, but where there's the now the proper rule over creation that was designed from the beginning. In other words, God, as he judges sin, as Christ rules from his throne, will again restore what was lost or marred in the fall. And we actually have a very, very good parallel with that with the nation of Israel. If you've looked over time, what we've seen is that in Exodus 19, as Israel is given the law, God says you should be what? A kingdom of priests. And their sin destroyed that, didn't it? They were a terrible kingdom of priests. They ended up being a mockery to the nations. They would have actually led people away from God if God had not judged them as he had. Their judgment was a testimony to who God was. But what do we see as Israel is renewed and restored, as their sins are repented of and as restoration is made? They move back into that position of being a kingdom of priests. And we saw that really clearly in the book of Zechariah, where the nations go to the Jews and say, take us with you to worship this king that is installed on Zion. You remember that? And we see that although their sin marred or destroyed, at least temporarily, that purpose that they were given, that the final restoration doesn't completely ignore or remove those things. It brings it back in, and it restores them to where they ought to be. So too with all of mankind, when the fall is reversed, when the curse is lifted from the earth, when the Lord rules rightly, man is again restored to his place that he ought to have over creation. So that again looks forward. Turn to Psalm 72. Psalm 72, there is not a whole lot of agreement about who wrote it. Likely Solomon, some people think David, but that's neither here nor there. It should be, what's written in here should have characterized the rule of the kings in David's line. They should have been righteous rulers that this psalm could have been written about. Of course, we know that through that line there were many, many more failures than there were successes. But as we read through this psalm, it is the idea of the righteous rule that is to come. And continually the verbs in this psalm are written in the future tense. They look forward to the nature of what is written. It looks to drive us forward to a king that is still yet to fulfill these things. Look at Psalm 72, verse 2. May he, that is the king, judge your people with righteousness and your afflicted with justice. Now, how many of the Davidic kings were supposed to rule like that? All of them were, weren't they? The role of the king was to shepherd God's people. He was, again, to lead in God's stead over God's chosen people. Lead in the way that God would have him lead. Now, how many of them did that? Very, very few. But it talks about this king who ought to judge with righteousness. You're afflicted with justice. And when that doesn't happen, he's one that's going to crush the oppressor. If you look down at verse 4, may he vindicate the afflicted of the people, save the children of the needy, and crush the oppressor. The Davidic king was one who was supposed to be able to do these things. He was supposed to rule rightly, and that righteous rule meant serving the needy, helping them, lifting them up, encouraging them, ensuring their survival, and at the same time, crushing the oppressors, exercising righteous judgment, and dealing out the proper punishment for sin in the nation. And again, that simply did not happen. But look down to verse 7. In his days may the righteous flourish. This looks forward, not in my days. The author is not saying in my days the righteous will flourish. No Davidic king really could ever say this. But in his days may the righteous flourish and the abundance of peace until the moon is no more. Now let's even look at right now. In our day, do the righteous flourish? Not necessarily. In fact, more often than not, righteousness is met by either a meh from the world, or indignation, even hatred. I mean, that's what we're going through in Peter, isn't it? I mean, he says, you shouldn't suffer for doing what's right, but you might. And if you do, suffer rightly. That's really kind of the bulk of the letter deals with that. But as we look to this psalm, he's saying, in this day, when this king rules, in his days, the righteous are going to flourish. There's going to be a recognition of what is right and wrong, what is just and unjust, and those that are righteous are actually going to flourish and prosper. So it's not happening now. But look at verse 8 through 11. What else will characterize this time? May he also rule from sea to sea and from the river to the clouds, or I'm sorry, and from the river to the ends of the earth. Let the nomads of the desert bow before him and his enemies lick the dust. Let the kings of Tarshish and of the islands bring presents. The kings of Sheba and Seba offer gifts. And let all the kings bow down before him and all nations serve him. What's the extent of the rule of this king? Complete, universal rule. Shore to shore, sea to sea, river to ocean, islands to Tarshish, which Tarshish was a designation for a far-off place. The islands were a far-off place. In case you didn't know, the Jews were not really a wildly seafaring people. They did not go out on great voyages. In fact, they didn't like the ocean at all. It was something terrifying to them for the most part. The ocean is always typically presented as something rather fearful, something unknown out there. This king will rule from the islands, from distant places. People will recognize the rule of this king, and what Davidic king ever accomplished that? Not one of them. Look down to verse 16. May there be abundance of grain in the earth on top of the mountains. Its fruit will wave like the cedars of Lebanon, and may those from the city flourish like the vegetation of the earth. May his name endure forever. May his name increase as long as the sun shines, and let men bless themselves by him. Let all nations call him blessed. Verse 16, there will be great blessing and abundance. And verse 17, may his name endure forever. May his name increase as long as the sun shines, and let men bless themselves by him. Let all nations call him blessed. What human king could ever take that kind of honor? None, rightly. To bless yourself by the name of a human king? That smacks of idolatry, doesn't it? That's dangerously close to what the pagan kings of the earth would have people do. It will not be inappropriate for this king. This king is one whose name will be rightly blessed by all the nations. Men will bless themselves by him. His name shall increase. His fame should increase and endure forevermore, and it will not only be appropriate, it will be entirely righteous and just when it happens. So Psalm 72 looks forward to the righteous rule of a coming king, and it is a universal king that will be characterized by victory over enemies, justice for his people, universal rule, and abundance and blessing. Turn to Psalm 89. Psalm 89 is a tricky one. It's not short, and it deals with a great amount of frustration. Psalm 89 deals specifically with frustration and failure. Well, how does that help us understand the kingdom? If for nothing more, it helps us understand how these conditions have simply not been met yet. Psalm 89 is filled with references, with looks back toward the Davidic covenant in 2 Samuel 7. So if you try to read Psalm 89 without reading 2 Samuel 7, you're going to feel a little out of place. But Psalm 89, verses 3 and 4, are kind of the foundational statement and reminder of the Davidic covenant. I have made a covenant with my chosen. That is what God said. I have sworn to David, my servant, I will establish your seed forever and build up your throne to all generations. That's the broad statement of God's promise to David, isn't it? I will build up your throne. I will establish your seed. And this covenant lasts for how long? Forever. And remember, as we look at the Davidic covenant, what kind of covenant was it? A bilateral covenant or a unilateral covenant? Unilateral covenant. It was one-sided. God said, David, you're not going to build me a house. I will build you a house. I will. And was David left to do anything on the other side of that? No. When your children sin, I will correct them. But in that same context, I'm not going to remove the blessing from them. They will certainly be disciplined, but it will not be removed. And then if you read verses 19 through 37, which we are not going to cover all of right now, verses 19 through 37 are essentially, it's a long statement of what that Davidic covenant would include, what it would mean to them, the idea that David was an anointed one, that the enemies would not strike out against him, that God's faithfulness would be with him in verse 24, and that in my name his horn will be exalted, that in the name of the Lord David's would be exalted, that he would call God Father, my God, the rock of my salvation. Verse 27, I will make him my firstborn, the highest of the kings of the earth, that there will be prominence for this Davidic king. Verse 33, I will not break off my loving kindness from him, nor deal falsely in my faithfulness. My covenant I will not violate, nor will I alter the utterance of my lips. My covenant, not yours, David. My covenant, not yours, Davidic kings. It's God's covenant because it's his terms. And he's not going to break it. He's not going to deal falsely. He's not going to go back on his word. And not only is he not going to violate it, but I love what he says in 34, nor will I alter the utterance of my lips. God is not going to adjust this. God is not going to come along at some point and say, all right, I know I said that you would rule over all the nations, but you guys are such a bunch of miscreants and creeps that I'm going to alter that and I'm going to change this and somehow it's going to be given to somebody else. God's not going to do that. God says, I'm not going to alter or adjust my covenants, which, by the way, Galatians backs up. You do not get to change the conditions of a covenant. Why do we insist that God literally fulfill the tenets of his covenant? Because that's the standard that God holds himself to. Here in Psalms and again in the writings of Galatians, that covenants are not made to be altered and adjusted as you feel they need to be. You don't get to make a business contract with the best of intentions, and then when things start to go poorly, decide that you're not going to hold up your end of it. No, the covenant is outlined, the tenets of it, the propositions are established, and you live up to them or you suffer the consequences of them. And we know that God is always faithful, so he will always live up to his side of the covenant agreements. Verse 35, I've sworn by my holiness, I will not lie to David. His descendants shall endure forever. His throne is the sun before me. It shall be established forever. And the witness in the sky is faithful. The idea that this covenant lasts forever and that God will be absolutely faithful to bring it about. Now that brings us to verse 38. And then if you read verse 38 to 45, what you see is extreme frustration on the part of the author. Because the psalm begins with God, this is what you promised, this is what you said, this is the wonderful promises that you gave to David, this is the nature of those promises. They're faithful, they're true, they'll never go away. And then starting in verse 38, it says, but that's not what's happening. But you've cast off and rejected. You're full of wrath. You've spurned the covenant. You've broken down the walls. You've exalted the adversaries. You turned back his sword. You've made his splendor cease. You've shortened the days of his youth. God, this is not what is happening. Because the author who wrote this has seen the failure of the Davidic kings. He has seen the division of a kingdom. He has seen the smallness of God's people be exalted as they've walked in disobedience. And he says, what is going on? This is not what you promised. This is not what it is supposed to look like. And it leads him to say in verse 46, how long, O Lord? See, sometimes that deals with direct affliction and enemies. And sometimes in the Psalms, it's asking for deliverance. In this case, it's saying, why is your promise appearing to fail? It's a pretty serious question, isn't it? It is very, very important that the psalmist included the first portion of this psalm that points to the faithfulness of God. And it is very, very critical that he ends with, blessed be the Lord forever, amen and amen. Because in his human capacity, he does not understand. The writer of this psalm has serious questions for God. And they are related to the fact that a king and a kingdom were promised, and that promise seems to have failed. Verse 49, where are your former loving kindnesses, O Lord? Where's that chesed that you showed us, that you swore to David? Remember the reproach. Remember what is happening, God. Well, why do we bring that up in the kingdom progress here? Because this is after David, this is after Solomon, this is after the best kings. They're not going to get any better from the time of writing this. In fact, they're going to get worse. The people anticipated the coming promise of God. It shows us that at no time in history were the full implications of the Davidic covenant realized by any of those kings. But it shows us that God's people, long after David and long after Solomon, still anticipated an actual king who would fulfill those requirements. He looks for a king that does not simply rule in the hearts of a few people that are faithful. He looks for a king that will actually physically rule over the nations of the earth. Turn to Psalm 110. It's our last one for today. We've already kind of hit on it a little bit here and there. It's a good psalm, but this psalm deals with the idea of the priest king. And it is a psalm that is addressed both to David's son and David's Lord. You remember, again, this is one that tripped up the Pharisees. Who is the one, Jesus asks, whose son is the Messiah? And they say David's son, right? He says, you're right. But if he's David's son, then how is it that David also calls him Lord? And this is what he's referring to. The Lord says to my Lord. Yahweh says to my Adonai. And David is writing this. So whoever he's writing it about is his son, but it is also his greater than. Sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet. This king will be one that sits at the right hand of the throne of God for a time. How long? Until. When is until? I don't know. But it is until. Now, it is not a permanent situation. Where is Jesus today? Where is Jesus? We know. We read Hebrews, right? Peter has said it. Where is Christ? At heaven, seating at the right hand of the Father. Is that a good thing? Yes, because what is he doing there? Interceding for us. Very, very good news for you and me, wretched sinners who continue to sin. He is in heaven at the right hand of the throne of God. Very, very important. Has God ever stepped off the throne? No. Other psalms speak of the God ruling from his heavenly throne forever and ever. There's no beginning or end to that. God sits on his throne in absolute authority over his creation. But look at what he says. Sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool. The Lord will stretch forth your strong scepter from where? Zion. Where's Zion? Jerusalem. Saying, rule in the midst of your enemies. You are going to sit on the throne. The Lord said to my Lord, Adonai, Christ, you will rule. Your scepter, your rule will go out from heaven? From Zion. He is not talking about the eternal heavenly throne of God. He is talking about a throne that is in Zion. This one, this Adonai, the Lord will rule in the midst of his enemies. Where are his enemies? In heaven? Certainly not. Where are they? On the earth. What have we seen? The nations are the ones that rebel against God. Think back to Psalm 2. The kings of the earth, the nations, say will cast off the shackles. And the Lord says, no, no, no. I have installed my king where? Zion. He's not talking about Christ simply remaining on the throne in heaven. That is not the rule that is promised to Jesus Christ. Does God rule from heaven at all times? Absolutely. We are not questioning that. But there is a distinct throne that is involved in these messianic promises. And whose throne is it? 2 Samuel 7, whose throne is it? David's throne. It's the Davidic covenant throne. It matters that you understand the distinction there, because otherwise you say, well, where does Christ rule from? Does he kick God off the throne for a little while and God the Father kind of hangs around in heaven? No, Christ is given a very specific, very distinct throne with very specific promises that he will rule the nations from one end of the earth to the other, that his rule will encompass all people and all things on earth. Does that mean God ceases to be in control of all things in heaven? No, don't try to parse your Trinity down that far. But Christ is given specific promises to be a king who rules from a throne in a specific location in Zion. Is that consistent with what we saw in the prophets? Yes. Isaiah, you'll rule from Jerusalem. Jeremiah, you'll rule from Jerusalem. Ezekiel, you'll rule from Jerusalem. Zechariah, he'll rule from Jerusalem. Over and over and over and over and over. Very, very consistent thought throughout all of the Old Testament. The Davidic throne is one that is exercised from Jerusalem. Verse 4, this will not only be a king, he will be a priest. The Lord has sworn and will not change his mind. You are a priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek. And we talked about how that was unheard of and unthinkable under the law. Your kings don't get to be priests. Kings are from what tribe? Judah. Priests are from what tribe? Levi, there you go. and the two do not cross or do not meet. You are from one or the other. This will be a different kind of king, a different kind of priest on the order of Melchizedek. And if you need that story, go back to Genesis chapter 14, read Genesis 14, Psalm 110, and then Hebrews chapter 7 through the end. And then verse 5, it goes back to those promises of kingly authority and victory. So we learn from Psalm 110 that this coming king will be David's Lord. He has authority over David, although he is a son of David, which you only get by being divine. He will rule not in the throne from heaven, but on the Davidic throne at a specific place from earth with specific promises to his rule. He will rule as a king and as a priest. A unique role, a new covenant role, not an old law covenant role. And he will rule with absolute victory over his enemies, verse 5 and following in that psalm. His authority is not one that gets to be challenged easily or without punishment. There's the Psalms. In the next couple of weeks, we are going to look at theological systems of interpretation, specifically millennial understandings. We'll give you some fun charts to deal with, because who doesn't love a good chart in the morning? And then we'll move on to the New Testament, and God willing, we will finish this at some point in June. If you have questions, comments, concerns, email, text, phone call, do something, get a hold of me, and we'll deal with it for everybody, all right?